fans, we can all listen to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Great show, bro. This is Sunny Side of Sports.
Right here on the Voice of America.
Voice of America.
This is VOA's Sonny Young in Washington. Welcome to the Sunny Side of Sports. Let's kick off with UEFA Champions League football. Europe's premier club competition continues this Tuesday evening with decisive round of 16 matches in France and England. The Reds of Liverpool almost surely will go through to the quarterfinals as they take a 5-0 advantage from the first leg into their home match against the Portuguese club Porto. In the French capital, Paris Saint-Germain enters its match against defending European champion Real Madrid, trailing 3-1 after the first leg. PSG needs to win by at least 2-0 to go through to the quarterfinals. The French club is without their Brazilian star Neymar, who is recovering from surgery on his foot and ankle. Real's Spanish captain, Sergio Ramos, says Neymar's absence on the pitch doesn't necessarily mean an easier task. And Real Madrid's French head coach, Zinedine Zidane, says his club will need to play good football for 90 minutes to make it through to the quarterfinals. At the pregame news conference in Paris, Zidane added that it's always a pleasure to return to France, but it's not about him or his personal interest. It's about what Real Madrid accomplishes on the pitch this Tuesday evening. In English Premier League football action Monday, the Serbian Nemanja Matic scored a stunning long-range goal in injury time as Manchester United came from 2 goals down to beat host Crystal Palace 3-2 at Selhurst Park. The win lifted Man U back into second place above Liverpool in the race for UEFA Champions League qualification behind runaway leader Manchester City. Man City has 78 points from 29 matches. Man U has 62 points. Liverpool has 60 points. And Tottenham Hotspur currently has that fourth Champions League qualification place with 58 points. Getting back to Nemanja Matic, he collected a loose ball from 25 meters out and sent a dipping shot into the corner for his first goal for Man U, adding to strikes from Chris Smalling and Romelu Lukaku. Now let's go to Marrakesh, Morocco, where the Confederation of African Football, CAF, is wrapping up its first ever women's football symposium. CAF says the two-day event is aimed at developing women's football in Africa and is being held under the theme Raising Our Game. CAF President Ahmad and FIFA's first ever female Secretary General, Fatma Samora from Senegal, are among those who attended the symposium. Participants were to discuss competitions, governance, the media, sponsorship, and the expansion of the women's game. I'm Sonny Young, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America.
The Voice of America.
VOA. Turning to African athletics, Ivorian sprinter Muriel Ahore is celebrating her first world indoor title. The 30-year-old Ahore won the women's 60 meters dash over the weekend at the IAAF World Indoor Championships in Birmingham, England. Muriel's time of 6.97 seconds is the fastest by a woman in 2018. Muriel was born in Abidjan, the commercial capital of Ivory Coast. She's the stepdaughter of General Matthias Due, who died last year at age 71 and who was chief of staff of the Ivorian Army from 2000 to 2004. As a young girl, Muriel traveled a lot, living in France, China, Japan, and Germany, before moving here to the United States at the age of 14. Muriel Ahore took up athletics in her sophomore or second year in high school. She then competed for the women's track teams at George Mason University, located just outside Washington, D.C., and the University of Miami in Florida. At the international level, Muriel is a two-time African champion for Ivory Coast, winning gold in the women's 100 meters in Durban in 2016, and another gold in the women's 200 meters in Marrakesh in 2014. Before Birmingham 2018, Muriel had come very close to being crowned world champion, winning two silver medals in the 60 meters at the World Indoor Championships and two more silver medals in the 100 and 200 meters at the 2013 World Outdoor Championships in Moscow, Russia. After capturing the gold in Birmingham, Muriel remembered her late stepfather.
I'm so excited. I've trained for this so hard this season. Going into the background training, my coach, Alan Powell, has told me, we need to get ready for indoors. And it was tough because I'm just coming off of a little bit of a depression. I lost my father last year to cancer. So it's been very, very difficult. And I just feel so blessed.
After being crowned world indoor champion in the women's 60 meters dash, Muriel Ahore was asked if she was surprised by her achievement.
I wasn't surprised. I ran the times in practice, but I was just so happy that I was able to put three perfect races together and then finally do it here, because it only counts if the world sees it, not when you're running, in the indoor gymnasium in Houston, Texas. So I'm just so excited to be able to have done it. That was the emotion.
That's world indoor champion Muriel Ahore of Ivory Coast. And Muriel was speaking at the recent IAAF World Indoor Championships in Birmingham, England. I'm Sonny Young, and you're listening to The Sunny Side of Sports on The Voice of America. If you tuned into Monday's show, you heard an interview that the energetic Andy Edwards did with Chris Turner, a top administrator for the IAAF. Let's listen in now to part two of their conversation, which focuses on Finland and its links to the great distance runners from East Africa. Here's Andy.
I've been covering sport for the sunny side of sports on VOA for about 20 years, and of course for some years before that. And naturally enough, distance running, especially in the last 20 years, has been dominated by the East Africans. And I'm sitting here in a hotel in Birmingham at the World Indoor Athletics Championships with somebody who knows a great deal about lots of athletics and especially history. And I do know that is Chris Turner, an IAAF administrator. And I know Chris has a special interest in Finnish athletics. And what I'd like to ask Chris about is, knowing about the great Finns, Paavo Nurmi and the others from the 1900s, 1920s, to wonder, were they similar to the great East Africans, Kenyans, Ethiopians, some Eritreans as well, that we see today? Chris, Paavo Nurmi, of course, one of the greatest runners of all time, but there were also Finns before him who won Olympic medals, like Hannes Coleman in 1912 and Nurmi in 1924. Is it valid to say, did they have any similarities in background to the African greats, Haile Gebrselassie, Kenenisa Bekele, Eliud Kipchoge? Any common ground there?
There's enormous connection, particularly on the national country level. And they say that Finland, that Kalamainen and particularly, ran Finland onto the world map. And we talk about Ethiopia, Kenya, they were colonial countries. Finland was a colonial country. It was a colony of Sweden and then latterly, before its independence, of Russia. And the way the Finns put their identity to the world, actually showed what Finland was through their sport and principally through athletics. And very similarly, Ethiopians and Kenyans have done the same. What do we think when we talk about Kenya or Ethiopia? We largely talk about their great athletes, the Abib Bakilas, the Haile Gebrselassies, the Paul Turgats, the Kip Kanos, and the similar way you mentioned Kolomayan, and we could run off this list, Nurmi, Rutola, Salmain, and there are so many, and I see immense similarities, this great national pride and passion to make their country known worldwide.
Interviewing the East African elite runners of today, I think it's fair to say most of them come from pretty basic backgrounds. They come from the country, the hill country, and it's not just about altitude, it's about having to use your legs and your physicality to go to school initially and then work, probably on a farm, or just you're using your body. Are there similarities with the Finns of the early 20th century in that as well?
Amazingly, quite even much later than that, my sort of mentor got me into athletics and communications was a gentleman called Matti Salamankala, who was the first press chief of our first World Championships. And he was a guy who sadly passed away just 6 or 7 years ago now. But even in the 1950s, the best way to go from one Finnish village to another was normally to get on a boat and go around the coast, or was to go through one of the forest paths, because the roads just were non-existent. So very similar to a Kenyan or an Ethiopian cutting through the country, walking to work, or running to school. That's what Finns were doing. In the winter, they would cross-country ski, another endurance sport. In the summer, they would be running across these country paths. So we have to talk as well. Finland went for industrialization very, very quickly. But in the 1920s and 30s, effectively, it was a rural agrarian population, and you had to run, you had to be physically active to get anywhere.
And that string of success lasted through to the 1970s, didn't it? We had Lasse Virran double Olympic golds, 5 and 10,000 metres. I mean, twice over doing the double. But then it's kind of faded. So I'm just wondering, I mean, I think many of us wonder, will the East Africans ever be knocked off their perch in general in terms of the distance running? If Finnish society has changed, would social changes, do you think, mean a diminution of the strength of the East Africans?
I seriously think that it could. Matti Hannes, a very good Finnish author, did the development of Finnish athletics through the ages, and on each chapter page showed how many cars there were in Finland, how many computers there were in Finland, and you see the correlation between a population who become more and more sedentary. Now Finland is one of the most technologically advanced countries in the world. 20 years ago, I visited one of my Finnish friends, that even there, on your mobile phone, a Nokia phone, you could order your tram ticket, something which we're only sort of doing now in Western Europe. But what I'm really saying is they moved, as I said before, from an agrarian society into an industrial society very quickly, and from there to a high technological society. If that sort of thing happens again with an Ethiopian or a Kenyan society, people will become more sedentary. That's just the way of it.
I think, just as a comment from me or a thought from me, I remember in one of these media huddles you have, you know, Haile Gebrselassie was being asked about his children, and he said, was the effect of, my children are not going to become runners, or not like me. I mean, they may run and do sport, of course, but their lives will mean they don't have to run. Feel that?
Absolutely. You look actually, okay, it was the amateur era, and there are a lot of questions about, was Nurmi making money? A lot of accusations, not about Nurmi, but so many of the Scandinavians. These were professional runners. These were people who were actually making good money. There was no other way to make money in Finland unless you were... These are the modern stars which we now look to today. They were the forerunners of those. And yeah, I really feel that society will change, and with that change, there is a problem for endurance sports.
Well, Chris Turner, really interesting thoughts about Finnish athletes of, well, quite a long ago and the modern era, and the East Africans, the Kenyans and the Ethiopians. We'll just have to look into our crystal balls more. Thanks very much, Chris.
Thanks very much, Andy.
And thanks to the energetic Andy Edwards for that interview with Chris Turner, a top administrator for the International Association of Athletics Federations, or IAAF. And Andy and Chris spoke at the recent IAAF World Indoor Championships in Birmingham, England. I'm Sonny Young, and you're listening to The Sunny Side of Sports on The Voice of America. Turning to tennis, Swiss star Roger Federer was back on the court Monday night in Northern California, and this time around it was for a good charitable cause. Joining us once again to tell us more is my VOA colleague, Gwen Uten. Sporty greetings, Gwen.
Sporty greetings, Sonny. Yes, last night, Roger Federer hosted his annual Match for Africa charity event. The exhibition event is given through his foundation to raise money for children living in poverty and to help support education projects in six different countries in Southern Africa. Federer spoke at the Match for Africa event about his efforts to shape as many lives as possible.
Well, we would like to reach a million kids by the end of the year. With this match tonight, I think I can confidently say we're going to do it.
The exhibition game was a doubles match, and Federer's partner was none other than Microsoft billionaire Bill Gates, which led one Facebook commenter to write, "It doesn't happen every day that Roger is not the richest guy on the court." Their opponents were American tennis player Jack Sock and TV news host Savannah Guthrie. The match was all lighthearted fun, and at one point, Federer dazzled the crowd with a point-winning at-the-net volley on his knees. The game was a best-of-three-sets match, and Federer and Bill Gates took the win 6-3. This is the second time Roger Federer and Bill Gates have paired up, winning both times. After this year's win, Bill Gates said, "I think I'm good at picking partners." Roger returned the compliment and then said this about Gates: "He knows numbers very well. He never makes mistakes on the scores. I do the running and Bill does the thinking." But winning the match wasn't the most important headline for Federer. On his official foundation page, Roger tweeted, $2.5 million raised at Match for Africa. Thank you, Savannah Guthrie, Bill Gates, and Jack Sock, for your incredible support. Recently, Federer was awarded the Sportsman of the Year and Comeback of the Year trophies at the Laureus Awards. In his speech, Federer said he hopes to be remembered as much for his philanthropic work as his tennis playing. One tweeter wrote, "Your legacy, Roger Federer, is sure to be just as great for your work for humanity as it will be for your talent on the court. The source for both is your heart of a champion." And an official tweet by the U.S. Open Tennis Federation says this: "The four previous Match for Africa events put on by Roger Federer have raised a combined total of nearly $8.5 million for charity." And Sonny, if you visit Roger Federer's foundation website, you'll see that he is very much approaching his million mark. I think we're all looking forward to seeing what he does next. Back to you.
Thanks, Gwen. That's my VOA colleague, Gwen Uten. And yes, Gwen, Roger Federer is definitely doing a lot of good off the tennis courts, too. Let's give him a Sunny Side of Sports salute for that Match for Africa held in San Jose, California on Monday evening. I'm Sonny Young, and you're listening to The Sunny Side of Sports on The Voice of America. Just 2 months before one of boxing's biggest fights of the year, Mexican star Saul Canelo Alvarez has tested positive for the performance-enhancing drug clenbuterol. Now, it's not clear at this point whether the positive test will affect Canelo's rematch with Gennady Golovkin, a.k.a. Triple G. Canelo and Triple G are scheduled to meet May 5th at the T-Mobile Arena in Las Vegas. Our VOA boxing fans will remember the two fought to a controversial draw last September. Triple G's promoter Tom Loeffler says, and I quote, I think we're all hopeful the fight can still go on, but I can't really comment until we have more details. Well, here are a few details about clenbuterol for our Voice of America listeners. The drug is often used to treat asthma, but it's on the World Anti-Doping Agency's list of banned substances because it also helps burn fat and build muscle. Clenbuterol has also shown up in drug tests for many Mexican athletes in recent years because of meat contamination in the country. Canelo says meat contamination caused his positive test. As part of the deal for the first fight, as well as the Canelo Triple G rematch, both boxers agreed to be randomly tested by the Voluntary Anti-Doping Association. Meanwhile, Canelo says he plans to immediately move his training camp from Mexico to the United States. In a statement, Canelo said, and I quote, "I am an athlete who respects the sport, and this surprises me and bothers me because it had never happened to me before. I will submit to all the tests that require me to clarify this embarrassing situation, and I trust that at the end, the truth will prevail." This is not the first time a top Mexican fighter has tested positive for clenbuterol in the lead-up to a fight. In 2012, Eric Morales blamed contaminated meat for his positive tests ahead of his rematch with then-junior welterweight world champion Danny Garcia in New York City. That fight went ahead as scheduled, and Garcia sent Morales into retirement with a fourth-round knockout. Meanwhile, our reigning prince of pugilistics, Namdi Hollywood Mueta, sent me an email, and Namdi described the news about Canelo testing positive as shocking. Namdi says there's also a chance the Canelo Triple G rematch could be moved from Las Vegas to Texas if the Nevada State Athletic Commission decides to take disciplinary action against Canelo. Once again, that Canelo Triple G rematch scheduled for May 5th, Cinco de Mayo in Las Vegas, Nevada, will have to wait and see if any disciplinary action is taken against Canelo. Another drug story in the cycling world. Former British star Bradley Wiggins says he's the subject of a malicious attempt to smear his name. Bradley has strongly denied accusations from British lawmakers that he used banned substances to enhance his performance while preparing to win the 2012 Tour de France. Wiggins says triamcinolone, I hope I pronounced that right, triamcinolone wasn't a medication that was abused in order to gain an advantage. Wiggins says instead it was used to treat a medical condition, asthma, that he said he had diagnosed in 2003. Bradley Wiggins and Canelo Alvarez under the drug testing microscope in the sports world. We'll see what pans out with both of those guys. In the National Basketball Association, another big game for LeBron James. He had 31 points on Monday night to lead the Cleveland Cavaliers to a 112-90 victory over the Detroit Pistons. Elsewhere, the Boston Celtics beat the Chicago Bulls 105-89. Jaylen Brown had 21 points for the Celtics. The Celtics seeking to dethrone the Cavaliers in the NBA's Eastern Conference. And that wraps up the March 6th edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. Thanks to Voice of America producer Bill Werkinger. Thanks also to VOA engineer John Dryden. And thank you for tuning in. I'm VOA Sonny Young in Washington, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. Through the efforts of the Iraqi Armed Forces, the Syrian Democratic Forces, and the Global Coalition to Defeat ISIS, ISIS has been defeated in Iraq and nearly so in Syria. Its self-proclaimed capitals have fallen, and its false caliphate is no more. But that does not mean that the terrorist group and its vicious ideology are no longer a threat to the global community. As we defeat ISIS on the battlefield, the group has adapted to our success, said Ambassador at Large and Coordinator for Counterterrorism Nathan Sales at the recently held International Conference on Mobilizing Law Enforcement Efforts to Defeat ISIS. The fight is by no means over. It's simply moving into a new phase. Battle-hardened terrorists are heading home from the war zone or wreaking havoc in third countries. Homegrown terrorists, people who are inspired by ISIS but have never set foot in Syria or Iraq, are carrying out attacks. And that means that in most cases, the brunt of the effort to keep the terrorists in check is shifting away from the military and toward civilian measures, including law enforcement, intelligence sharing, diplomatic engagement, messaging, and foreign assistance. Many of the counterterrorism steps the global community is already taking in this direction are enumerated in UN Security Council Resolution 2396, which was adopted in December. These measures include a watch list of known and suspected terrorists, information sharing, including of passenger name records, prosecutions of fighters returning from the battlefield and those inspired by ISIS, and designations to cut off the flow of money to terrorist organizations and their members. In addition, each country should take advantage of Interpol's databases that will fill in the gaps in domestic watch lists. All countries should enact laws that cover and penalize a wide range of terrorist activities. These are the tools prosecutors need to handle the next phase of the ISIS threat. And finally, all countries must develop the necessary legal regimes to designate and sanction terrorists, thus allowing the global community to cut off their financing. My hope, said Ambassador Sales, is that this conference will help us focus our attention on achieving the enduring defeat of this depraved terrorist organization, as well as Al-Qaeda and self-directed terrorists who were inspired by these groups.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Hello, I'm Lenore Moudou, host of Health Chat. March 8th is International Women's Day, so next week on Health Chat, we will discuss maternal health and look at possible ways to avoid preterm birth and other common complications during pregnancy. Our guest is Dr. Keisha Gaither, a double board certified physician in OBGYN and maternal fetal medicine and director of perinatal services at Lincoln Medical and Mental Health Center in New York. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The U.S. country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. Health Chat this Tuesday at 1730 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, voters in Sierra Leone go to the polls on March 7th to elect a new president, parliament, and local councils. President Ernest Bai Koroma is stepping down after serving two terms. His presidency faced the Ebola outbreak and allegations of corruption. An in-depth discussion on the most pressing issues facing Sierra Leone on the next Straight Talk Africa at 1830 UTC.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. VOA. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5 minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.